Today's Teisho will be on case 46 in the Mumonkan. Case 46 is entitled Proceed On From the Top of the Pole. Sekiso Osho asked, how can you proceed on further from the top of the 100-foot pole? Another eminent teacher of old said, you who sit on the top of a 100-foot pole, although you have entered the way, you are not yet genuine. Proceed on from the top of the pole, and you will show your whole body in the 10 directions. Mumon's comment, if you go on further and turn your body about, no place is left where you are not the master. But even so, tell me, how will you go on further from the top of the 100-foot pole, eh? Mumon's verse, he darkens the third eye of insight and clings to the first mark on the scale. Even though he may sacrifice his life, he is only a blind man leading the blind. I want to thank everybody for getting up and coming here to practice Zen this morning. It's quite important to get up in the morning early. Almost anything can be accomplished if you can get up early. Time is quite elastic. You know, I have a busy life, and I'm sure many people here have busy lives, but one of the remarkable things is that you can always seem to get a little extra time if you wake up early. I was a typical college student when I started graduate school. I would get up at 8 or 9, and if I had a class, I would get up at 7. And so on. And then I ran into a Zen monk, a Japanese monk named Takabayashi Genki, and I began to practice Zen with him. And for the first year, I would sit about once a week. I would go, we had meditation at the university, just like here, and I would go and sit with Genki Roshi and the Seattle Zen Center, as it was then called, met in the art building on the University of Washington campus, and I would sit there on Wednesday night. And it helped me. It really was quite wonderful. I didn't understand why, but I felt better after meditating. Unfortunately, a couple other people who were new to the group, as I was, would meet me after the sit. We'd all go to the sit, and we would do our meditation. And it was difficult for me. Getting through three periods of meditation was hard. Getting through 25 minutes was hard. Sometimes I would feel like I was sweating, just trying to get to the end of a 25-minute period. But after the evening was over, I felt purified. It was as though a cool breeze had blown across my face, or my mind was refreshed in a way that was like nothing else I had ever encountered. You know, you can go to a movie if you're stressed out, and you can relax, you can have a drink, you can go for a jog, but there was something about meditation that was very deeply liberating. You know, I felt very good after meditating. Unfortunately, my friends and I would all get together after the sit, and we'd go over and have a big glass of beer. And so we would all sit together over at the university tavern and have a big glass of beer, and the next day I would get up with kind of a hangover. And it would undo all the good effects of my sitting. I guess at some point I realized that the beer was not going well was not harmonizing well with the meditation practice. But I continued to practice every Wednesday night for about a year, and then I had been to several sesshin. I had gone to several sesshin, and we started to have meditation in the morning. And I started to sit with Genki Roshi at his place in the morning. And it was hugely difficult for me to get up at 4:30 in the morning. It was extraordinary how tired I would be during the week. And just really, it was a shock to my system. But I did it for many, many years, and eventually I began to really love it. I remember my friend John Sunston would come and pick me up in his Volkswagen bus. And he had a Volkswagen bus that had no heater in it. The heater was shot. And he had just gone through a difficult divorce, and he didn't really have the money to fix it. So he would come and pick me up at my house, and we would drive to Kugeon, the Roshi's place in South Seattle. And it was a lovely place. It was up on a hill, and you had to drive up the hill to get to the Roshi's place. And there was quite a nice view. You could see a lot of... It was sort of on a mountain, almost. And there were some other houses as you drove up the mountain. And I would go in and sit down on the cushion and just... have the most wonderful sit. And Genki Roshi felt that it was important to have an authentic zendo, so every morning during the winter he would open up the windows. And we would sit there in the dark, in the cold, I think it was like 5 o'clock or 5:30 in the morning, something like that. And we would sit until 7, and then we would have breakfast, and breakfast was miso soup, rice, miso soup, some stir-fried vegetables, and a daikon pickle. And then we'd all go off to our jobs. It was really a beautiful experience. It was a shock for me to get up that early, and it took me a while to adjust. But I realize now that morning is the very best time to do meditation. It's really quite wonderful. You know, if you get up in the morning and you sit, like as we did today, it's the most precious sit of the day. You know, if you've come to sesshin, you know that, you know, we sit many hours, but there's something about that morning sit. It's as though the whole world is opening up in front of you, you know? It's the most wonderful thing. You can work very hard. You could go to bed really tired and maybe discouraged. You know, you could be a little discouraged. Sometimes, you know, by the end of a day, you can feel that you've had it. It's like, I've had it, you know. You go to sleep and you might think, what am I going to do? You know, what am I going to do? I just don't know. Maybe you have, you know, big problems. Or maybe in your work you're stuck on some technical issue that you can't resolve. You know, maybe you're hurting. You know, maybe there's something that's happened to you emotionally. And, you know, when you go to bed sometimes you can feel, oh, man, life, you know. But if you get up in the morning early and you sit down on the cushion, you can experience the most delicious openness. It's really there. It's really palpable, you know. It's like the world is beckoning you. It's like the world is opening up for you. You know, it's like it's opening. I think that, you know, in many traditions, morning is thought to be the best time for meditation. And, you know, if you were a scientist, you might know that it's tied in with your internal clock or something like that, and your endocrine system, for all I know. But there's something special about that morning sit. It's like you went to bed last night and you thought, all the doors were closed. And you get up in the morning and it's as though all the doors have opened. And anything can happen. Anything can happen. You know, that's the most remarkable thing. I think the key is that when you meditate, if you're really meditating, and it's easier to meditate in the morning when your mind is clear. If you're really meditating, your mind is in the moment more fully. You know, sometimes when you meditate at night, all the tape loops play in your head. So you sit down on the cushion and a lot of the baggage from the day comes back up. It replays in your head. When you wake up in the morning, I think your unconscious mind has done a lot of that work over the course of the night. And when you get up, your mind is more centered, it's more present in the moment. And then, you know, when you sit, you're really, really in the moment, really with the moment. And that's where that openness comes from, you know. The moment is really, you know, if you practice Zen for a long time, I think you'll realize that the moment is remarkably open. You know, it's really quite extraordinary. You know, as I say, you know, you can go to bed at night and you think, I'm boxed in. There's nothing I can do. You know, what am I going to do? You know, how many times have we asked ourselves that? You know, I'll never forget. I myself was struggling. I was in graduate school, and I was having a very hard time with a certain professor. He was famous in the department for giving graduate students a very hard time. His name was Don. I'll just say Don B. I'll leave him. His anonymity will be somewhat preserved. Don B. And Don B., I wrote a paper for him, and he actually failed the paper because he didn't like the critical approach I used. And he basically wanted me to start from scratch and use his critical approach. It was extraordinary. I'd never been mauled by somebody like that before. And he really tore me to pieces. And so I just thought, well, maybe I don't belong in graduate school. You know, this is really, you know, maybe I'm stupid, blah, blah, blah. And I remember going to bed thinking, what'll I do? You know, in every direction I'm trapped. In every direction I'm boxed in. And by the way, this is an illusion created by projective thinking. It's an illusion created by projective thinking. We do it all the time. You know, we think tomorrow is going to be like today. You know, or we think a year from now, it'll be like now. And this is very common. We think this way all the time. We extrapolate from the present moment and imagine how the future is going to be. And so, it can be very positive. If things are going very well right now, we imagine the future as being this wonderful, it'll just be like this on and on. Now, most people don't think that way. I think a lot of people tend to take a more negative view. So we tend to extrapolate often from our negative experiences. And so, you know, if you're having trouble at work, you know, sometimes, especially if you're feeling a little blue, a little down, you'll project that experience out over the years and think, oh my God, how am I going to get through another, you know, X number of years in this job, you know, with this sort of situation. And I think we can do that at night when we're going to bed, you know. We project and we think, oh, what will I do? What will I do, you know? This is projective thinking. But when you get up in the morning and you sit down on the cushion and your mind is fresh and you're really just in the moment, there's this wonderful, wonderful sense of openness. And I think this is like the heart of Zen practice, you know. The moment is radically open. when we come to the moment with all of these presuppositions and all of these projections and all of these inferences about what's likely to happen next, you know, we can begin to feel very closed in, very boxed in, very trapped. But when we're really in the moment, we discover this great openness, you know, this really wonderful. And I don't think I'm not a big fan of, when I was growing up, there used to be a book called by, I think his name was Peale, Norman Vincent Peale. It was called The Power of Positive Thinking. And he basically said, don't let yourself have negative thoughts. Just think positive thoughts. I think there's something artificial about trying to have thoughts of a certain kind, you know? I do. But I think the moment really is open in a way that it isn't something we impose on it. I think it's really quite remarkable. And I think it's the reason Zen feels so good sometimes is that we're just in the moment experiencing this openness. I was, this week, some of you might know, I wasn't at the sit on Wednesday night because I was in a court in Elizabeth, New Jersey. And if some of you have been to Elizabeth, by the way, is where my father grew up. And I hope it was better when he was a boy. Because it's a dump, if I may say so. I hope nobody's feelings are being hurt. But I just, every time I go there, I just think, what a dump, you know. And the town is, depressed. I mean, when you drive down the street, there's hardly any stores that with names you recognize because nobody builds, none of the conventional chains have built a store downtown. There are all these very sort of knockoffs and a lot of stores that sell no brand items and things like that. Downtown is quite dirty also and very high crime. I was there because I was called for jury duty on Wednesday. And I got there at 7:45. I think I was supposed to be there at 8:00. And the first thing the man who greeted us said was, your car probably won't be broken into. That's what he said. He said, hopefully you didn't leave anything of value on the seat of your car. And he said, to entice people to break in. But he said, your car will probably be okay. And so then we were kept in this room, like a holding tank for jurors, for hours, and then we were allowed to go to lunch. And fortunately, I found a Chinese restaurant. Wouldn't you know? There was a Chinese restaurant. And by the way, it was delicious. I was thrilled. I thought, what a break! And it was really good. I was shocked. And I went up and complimented the people behind the counter. I said, that was excellent, you know. And they were smiling and... So really good food, in spite of the fact that this is a terrible dump. Then I came back from lunch, and they finally took us into the courtroom. And if you know the procedure, it's extremely tedious. They're trying to seat a jury. And you have both teams of lawyers and a judge. And they have people come up and basically you have to answer some questions about whether you believe in the American jury system and other things like that. And then, the judge said, this case probably won't go longer than 3 weeks. I thought, oh my God, 3 weeks. And so, you know, what happens is that the two sides, the two groups of lawyers are playing a game. They both want the jury they think they can manipulate most effectively. And so they're seating jurors, and the judge asks people what they do for their living. It was fascinating in a horrible sort of way. You know, the judge would put people on the stand, and some people were quite intelligent and articulate, and many people were quite, if I may say so, not very well educated, very inarticulate. And I was shocked at how few people. The judge said, well, do you, where do you get your news? A newspaper? You know, people, it was like, what's a newspaper? You know, and it was shocking. And he said, do you listen to get your news on TV? I was waiting to hear Fox News, you know. But the thing was that a lot of people just don't listen to the news. And some people had real hardships. One guy was a waiter in New York, and I thought, oh, he's lost a day's wait. The judge let him go because he didn't, you know, it would be a very big hardship to be on this jury. And it was an injury case, basically. A person had been driving down the street, and in front of him was a dump truck. And a rock flew out of the dump truck and went through the window of his car and caused him serious injury. He was hospitalized. He required physical therapy. Might have sustained other injuries. I don't know. So they were going to have medical testimony and so on and so on. One of the people on the jury, in the jury pool, was a doctor. And he was seated and then he was taken off. You know, the judge put him on the stand. He was acceptable. They put him in the jury box, but one of the lawyers probably began to think, he knows too much about medicine, he won't accept my evidence, and they took him off. They can put you on one, you know, they can challenge a juror and remove him. Well, anyway, this went on all day Wednesday, all Wednesday afternoon, and then it went on for much of Thursday. So I didn't come to the sit, and by the way, you're not allowed to have paper or pencils in the courtroom. You're not allowed to have your phone on. You can't have a word processor. You can't have your computer with you. You just have to sit there, and it's grindingly boring. It's just astonishing, right? And I was sitting there thinking, oh, I have so much to do. You know, I am so behind. I have to get this grant proposal done. I have papers to grade. I have to get, you know, I have something I have to write. It's due in 2 weeks. And I'm sitting here and I'm unable to do any of it, you know. And as I was sitting there, I was beginning to feel very boxed in, you know. I don't know if you know that feeling, but it's like pressure. Everybody knows this feeling of pressure. But then, you know, you can also have a feeling that goes beyond pressure. It's like you're claustrophobic, right? It's like you're beginning to feel a little trapped, right? And that happens to me sometimes when I have lots and lots of work. I'm beginning to get this claustrophobic feeling, you know. And so I was sort of listening out of one side of my brain to this incredibly boring exchange between the judge and one of the potential jurors. And then I started thinking about all the stuff I had to do, and then I was thinking, but I can't do it, and now I'm going to be even more behind. And then I began to feel pressure, and then I began to have that feeling of claustrophobia, right? Okay. So then I thought, and I'm surprised it didn't come to me sooner, I thought, wait, why don't I meditate? And I couldn't pull my legs up. That might have gotten me out of court right away. You know, but I didn't have the nerve to do that. I should have done that and gone, oh. Out. You're out. You're released. Goodbye. So I didn't do that, but I just sat there quietly, and I thought, oh, this is probably not going to work very well, and it worked beautifully. It was like I sank down into, to my great surprise, I sank down into deep samadhi, and it was wonderful. It was wonderful. After a while, I felt this openness. I didn't imagine this. You know, this just, it was so palpable. I felt this openness, and it was just so wonderful to be in that openness. And I remember these lines from a sutra we recite at Sesshin, the vastness that underlies us all. And I thought, this is it. This is the vastness that underlies us all. And it was just heaven. It was so liberating. And I realized, you know, this is here all the time. It's here all the time. Your mind has to be on a certain wavelength to find it. But it's here all the time. And you know, like everybody else, you know, I live in a world of, you know, deadlines and pressures and you know, I have all the anxieties of anybody else. You know, I what if we don't get the grant? You know, what if this happens? What if this happens? You know, and I'm concerned about what other people will think of me. I'm concerned about, you know, of course, you know, being a human being, all of those things are important to me too. And those can create this tremendous sense of pressure and finally sense of like no way out, you know, no way out. There's a very famous play by a French playwright named Jean-Paul Sartre. And it's called Huis Clos, No Exit. And it's about three people who are basically in hell. I mean, literally in hell. And they're forced to interact for eternity with each other. Sartre was not a happy man, if I may say so. They're forced to interact with each other for eternity, and their behavior patterns and expectations and fears and anxieties are all very bad. Let's say the chemistry is very bad. One man is hugely in love with this other woman who doesn't love him. She loves the other person, but the other person doesn't reciprocate her affection, and they go round and round and round. And Sartre's conclusion is that hell is other people, right? And the end, right? Okay. So naturally, that play became hugely popular with intellectuals for about 30 years. But nevertheless, we have options. We don't have to live that way, and yet we all feel that way sometimes, right? We all feel, you know, that this is like hell. You know, I'm so boxed in. I keep repeating these. You know, you can be in relationships with people and you just can't change them. You know, this is quite common. You know, you can't figure out. I've worked with people sometimes and I can't figure out how to change my relationship with them. It doesn't work, but I don't know what else to do. You know, I don't know if you've ever been in that situation. And so every time I get involved with this person, it's the same cycle. You know, so Sartre had a point. And sometimes our human relations can have this character of being like Huis Clos, no exit. And sometimes our most personal, like family relationships, are often like that, right? Where you keep trying to break through, but it just cycles back into the same thing. And so I think it's tremendously easy to feel boxed in and to feel like there's no way out. And this is really a quite common mindset, and it's, you know, it's one of the reasons people get depressed, right? I mean, or become sad. You know, you feel there's nowhere to go. There's no direction that I can take which is going to open up. I can't look in any direction and see a resolution to this problem. But see, that's the problem of prospective thinking. Knowing what I know now, I can't imagine a future which will be different, and that's naturally the case. But if you think about it, things change all the time in ways we don't anticipate. You know? I was so excited by what happened in Egypt, you know, over these last 10 or 15 days, you know. Egypt has been under a dictatorship that's like an iron dictatorship, a police state, for 30 years. And Mubarak has this huge bureaucracy working for him, and there are spies everywhere, and there's police everywhere. And if you criticize the government, you can lose your job. People are constantly afraid. They are bribed. You know, lots of people are on the secret payrolls and things like this. And it's been an absolutely hellish. It's been like a SART, you know, like no exit. And the people of Egypt have been so ground down by this system that they've been quite dispirited. And it just seems like this is the last place on earth you would expect change. And so for 30 years there's been this incredible inertia. And of course, you know, we've been involved in funding the government in Egypt, very heavily bankrolling them. And that gives them even more power, and they have this huge resource of American money to stay in control. But then, all of a sudden, totally unexpectedly, there was a popular uprising. And they had no weapons, they had no plan, they had no leadership. It's very much like what happened in Tunisia, where basically, the revolution in Tunisia started when some poor college student who couldn't get a job opened up a food stand. And then the police came and shut him down because he didn't have a license. And he was so desperate, he set himself on fire, like a Buddhist monk in Vietnam. He ignited himself and died. And all these young people in Tunisia who have no opportunities and who are basically robbed by their government went ballistic. And there too, it wasn't a violent revolution, but they took to the streets and they toppled their government. Now, you know, nobody would have predicted this. Yesterday afternoon, I took a break. I was working on something and I read an article about how the CIA had failed to predict either of these. You know, by the way, the CIA, generally speaking, fails to predict anything. You know, it's astonishing. The CIA didn't predict the fall of the Soviet Union. You know, they missed it. They were thinking of something else that day. Right? It was probably the most important event since World War II, and nobody in the CIA understood it was going to happen. And by the way, nobody, you know, all over the United States at one time, there were departments of Russian and Soviet studies. They were usually housed in departments of political science or area studies. But all over the country, almost every major university had a number of like Soviet experts, and these were people who were like often like Russian defectors or people who had worked for the CIA at one time, and now were professors, and none of them predicted the fall of the Soviet Union. Nobody saw it coming, and when it fell, it just collapsed. And nobody saw this coming. These were the last places anybody expected to have change. Now this is like on the macro level. This is like the macro level. And change on the macro level is so hard to have happen, right? It's like you have these huge structures, and you know the government in Egypt was this massive bureaucracy, just an incredibly inert, unchanging, intractable, and yet you know it's like a new dawn in a place where nobody expected it to happen. And this is I think a real lesson to us, right? It's a real lesson, because you know we always project the current circumstances forward and think there's no way out, you know. And of course, if you had done that in Egypt only 6 months ago, you would have assumed change in Egypt will never come. It will never, ever, ever come. But it's come, right? And now suddenly people are filled with a sense of possibility and a sense of, the, you know, really, all those people, I think, who went into the square at the center of Cairo were experiencing the openness of the moment. It's like all of a sudden they realized history doesn't really matter. The moment has a kind of openness that is very liberating. And people kept saying, you know, I was listening to this American diplomat who was saying, well, this was before Mubarak stepped down. He said, well, we hope Mubarak will step down gradually, and we hope there's gradual change, and we hope everybody will obey the laws. And some reporter said, but Mubarak made the laws. I was so happy to hear that. Like, why would anybody obey the laws, you know? You get trapped. I mean, the reporter himself, I mean, the State Department person was thinking in terms of the past, right? The past is what will happen in the future. That these laws have to be obeyed. And the reporter said, but wait, that's the past. We don't have to obey the past. There's a kind of openness to things. And that it was a question that was really quite illuminating, I thought. And this is on the macro level, and when it happens on the macro level, it's astonishing to everybody, right? It's just astonishing. But it can happen in our lives all the time, too. You know, I mean, nobody can really predict where they will be 6 years from now. It's just not possible. You know, if you look at, I was just reading the biography of Mayor Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, who's this fabulously wealthy person. And he started out, when he got out of college, do you know what he was doing? He worked parking cars in New York City. So if you had seen this young kid 40 years ago parking cars in New York, you would have said, well, there's no way he's going to be mayor of New York, right? There were people who had many more advantages than Bloomberg, but somehow, you know, it just happened this way. There was a kind of openness to things, you know? He happened to take economics courses. He happened to have the right professor. He happened to find a niche at a time that nobody, the niche that nobody else discovered, you know. And these things roll along in ways that are highly unpredictable, you know. Our lives have a kind of openness that we don't always appreciate because we think projectively, prospectively, you know. And one of the beautiful things about meditation is that it can cut that off. It can free us from that kind of thinking. And we can begin to experience the openness of the moment. I was reading something in the paper just yesterday that I thought was so interesting. Some brain scientist has come up with a kind of thinking cap. They aren't going to market it yet, so it's not available. But basically what they do is it sends electrical pulses into one side of your brain. And it sort of silences that side of your brain. It's the side of the brain that's very logical and observes rules. You know? I guess that would be the left, drawing with the right. With the left. That's the left, I think. I get the hemispheres confused, but I think it's the left side of your brain, right? Is the logical side. Well, maybe it's the other side. But the point is, one of your hemispheres controls your sense of what's possible. And it's very much rule-oriented and very logical and rational. And that's the side that this thinking cap puts to sleep. It sends a bunch of little pulses into that part of the brain and sort of like drowns out the electrical signals from that part of the brain. And the other part of the brain starts to become more liberated. The part that is intuitive and grasps patterns and is creative. And of course, I thought of meditation. Because I think meditation very much does that. You know, you sit on the cushion, and usually when people start, especially if they have problems, you know, they think obsessively about their problems. And of course, when you think that way, you always come back to the conclusion that nothing can be done, right? It's absolutely reliable. It's like, I'm going to think my way out of this. But when you try to think your way out of it, you wind up right back at square one again. Because that's the kind of thinking you're doing, right? You're starting with the assumption that things are going to be always the same. And this is why I'm very skeptical about that kind of thinking. Because generally speaking, it is rather self-defeating. You know? But when we meditate, sometimes we enter this state which is more open. And it's more associative and playful. And it feels better, right? It's the vastness that underlies us all. And you get this sense, you have this feeling sometime of openness or freedom. And it feels that anything is possible. You know, today when I was sitting, I got that feeling, that wonderful feeling that, you know, like anything is possible. Anything is possible. And it's a beautiful feeling. Like everybody else, I don't spend all my time there, you know. Sometimes I'm thinking, oh my gosh, you know, what am I going to do? There's no way out, you know. And that's depressing. That's disabling, you know. And then you go to bed and think, you know, oh brother, maybe I'll feel better in the morning. And then you get up and you sit on the cushion. And you realize, you know, I never thought of this, but I could do this, you know. So there's something wonderful about the openness of the moment that meditation makes available to us. You know, this koan is all about that. You know, traditionally this koan is given to people when they're very close to the end of their training. So it's called proceed on from the top of the pole. So it's like you've climbed, you've gone through all your Zen training. And now you've climbed all the way up, but you're on the top of this pole. And you have to step off the pole. And of course, there's a part of your mind that says, if I step off the pole, I'll fall to earth and I'll be killed, you know. But this is the mind that is projective, right? And it imagines that the future has to be like the past. And of course, you know, we all have in our past a history of falling off of various things and landing hard, right? That's something we've all experienced, and it tends to erode our trust, right? But you know, there's this wonderful openness to the moment, and you know, basically, it's at that very minute when you think, that very moment when you think that nothing can be done, you know, that you need to sit. That's when you need to do meditation. And you may sit there with your thoughts going in a vicious circle for a long time. But if you can just let go and be present in the moment, it's like this door opens up. And there's this wonderful spaciousness. And you realize, you know, tomorrow could be very different. You know, could be very different. And will be very different. The possibilities I can't see now are right there, you know. And that's not wishful thinking. It's the way things really are. There's always this openness to the moment, this wonderful possibility. You know, I can remember sitting earlier I was talking about sitting with Genki Roshi in Kugeon, his place. And he would open the windows every morning, and we'd sit in the freezing cold. And I can remember sitting there thinking, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? What am I going to do? And Genki Roshi must have, maybe he had problems of his own, you know, I don't know. Or maybe he sensed that I was struggling. But out of the blue, he said, life is just impossible, you know? Life is just impossible. And, you know, in a certain mood, that could be really depressing, right? Life is just impossible. But he had this beautiful smile on his face. because, you know, it is impossible, and yet somehow we keep going. And it's there's a kind of energy, life energy, that we can have access to when we can free ourselves from this projective thinking, and when we can just be fully in the moment. And it's like a secret weapon, right? It's like, you know, life can be difficult, life can be challenging. But what happens to people is they become prisoners of their own discouragement, you know? It's like, I have to say, in my mother's family, people were very sort of like bleak. My mother's family, they've all had very rough lives. They grew up in a part of the country that's very difficult to live in. And they were sort of like New Englanders. They really aren't New Englanders, but they had that kind of like very spare, sort of bleak outlook. And it was like, tomorrow is going to be bad. I just know it, you know. They have like that kind of like, it's kind of like, of course it's all going to turn out badly. How else could it turn out, right? This is sort of my mother's family. They're sort of like that, you know. And I think that attitude is quite common, you know, actually. You know, I think we all have some of that, you know. But when I feel, when I find myself feeling that way, I know Sit has to be in my future pretty soon, right? And I sit down on the cushion and I realize that's not the voice, that's not true. It's not true. Anything can happen. You know, the world is quite open all the time. And we really defeat ourselves in a way by not being able to get in touch with that openness, you know. So I think this is one of the most crucial things that meditation can do. It is to put us in touch with the openness of the moment, the real openness of things. And, you know, right now we're in this inspiring moment where it's so obvious that things are far more open than we ever thought. You know, for the people of Egypt, I think are just, well, you know, my friend John Sunston, I've talked about this. When I started doing Zen practice, I started training with a man named John Sunston, who was a professor of neuroanatomy in the medical school at the University of Washington. And John has a lifelong friend of mine. He's now 77. And he sent me an email to me yesterday, to me, Wendy Nicow, who's an old friend of his, the abbot of the Los Angeles Zen Center, Wendy Nicow's boyfriend or husband, a guy who's a brain scientist at UW, and also to Webb, and to me, and just a couple other people. And he said, I'm watching the fall of the government in Egypt on TV, and all those people in the square, and he said, the tears are running down my face. And I understand completely, you know, that freedom is so inspiring, you know. And you think, where did it come from? You say, where did it come from? Because nobody planned it. You know, there really was nobody 6 months ago had a committee and thought it all out, you know. And even though a lot of people thought there might be a secret plot, there really wasn't any secret plot, you know. It came out of nowhere, really. And that's such an important lesson, right? That, you know, just when we think there's nowhere to turn, you know, that's when we think there's nowhere to turn, we're not telling the truth, you know. We're defeating ourselves. And when we sit on the cushion and we stop that voice that says, there's no way out, no way out, no way out. And you begin to just rest serenely in the moment. Sooner or later, there's this energy that comes from the openness of things. And you begin to feel connected. And every, you know, one of the Buddha's most basic teachings was that everything is constantly changing. Constantly changing. And so the idea that things can't change, that they're immovable and unchangeable, this is like an illusion. It's our fear talking, right? But But actually, everything is alive in this very profound way. And everything is constantly changing and constantly open. And to discover that, all you have to do